Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Morning, Jim and Austin. A lot has happened since we talked a couple of weeks ago. Definitely in Libya, that whole thing has changed, right, Jim?
Yeah, we did a piece a few days ago called The Endgame in Libya, where we basically laid out, you know, how the war was being fought and how it was going to end. Without intervention, as happened in Afghanistan in 2001, the rebels are just going to be ground up. Indeed, the Afghan rebels were in better shape than the Libyan rebels are now, because Gaddafi is able to use his minuscule, you know, navy to basically blockade the major cities. You know, 80% of the population lives in the city. The entire population is dependent upon imports for food. The country doesn't, you know, grow enough. It never did, or rarely did. And he's basically starving them out. That's why one of his sons is probably quite accurate in saying Benghazi is going to be gone in 48 hours, because they're not letting any ships in. I mean, ships were coming in, bringing in supplies and taking people out. That's not apparently not happening anymore. Plus, he's got his minuscule air force. You know, Gaddafi's only got about, you know, maybe 10,000, you know, fighters, as it were. He's got two or three times that as many, you know, thugs, cops, secret policemen, whatever you want to call it. And they're undoubtedly terrorizing the dickens out of the people in the cities that have been conquered, as it were. You know, it's a very small change war. And when it's all over, everybody's going to be whipping themselves. It'll be like Rwanda. Well, gee, why didn't we do something? Now, that's a long story. They're still, you know, arguing over why they didn't do anything in Rwanda. But nobody wants to do anything in, well, a lot of people want to do, but nobody is doing it for Libya. And so Libya is going to become another one of those police state horror shows everybody complains about, but like the weather, nobody does anything about.
Yeah, I would imagine that they'll be marching people in the streets here soon and, you know, executing.
Mass grave sites, Dan.
Right.
Well, of course, that's the problem with these situations. Politicians look at it and say, well, if we do something, we're going to be criticized. And if we don't do something, we'll be criticized. But they notice that if you don't do something, you're criticized less.
Right.
So it's simple math.
Now, we had an interesting...
Maybe morally illiterate, but they're not, you know, innumerate.
Now, we had a really interesting article that you did that a lot of people jumped on and read about the Egyptian 777 unit going into Libya.
Yes, that's another story that will come out later. There may be even a movie out of that, you know, with an unhappy ending, of course. Apparently, there are several countries had sent some of their special forces in there. The British were embarrassed when some of their guys got arrested by the rebels. And the Egyptians have kept it very much on the down low, basically just trying to find out first who was on first, you know, who is doing what to whom. The Egyptians have a long history of bad relations with Libya. In fact, in 1977, I got a visit from a deputy chief of staff of the Egyptian Armed Forces when I was running SBI, and he had been sent up from the Army War College, and the general, lieutenant general, wanted some help in wargaming operations against Libya. That was a very interesting meeting. Anyway, the situation hasn't changed. I mean, the Egyptians have basically made their peace. You know, Gaddafi no longer, you know, pulls the, you know, the beard of the Egyptians, which is how that all started in the first place. But the Egyptians still feel that it's unfair that Libya, with 6 million people, has all that oil, and Egypt, right next door, with 80 million people, has very little. That may still change. In fact, it might have changed if there hadn't been a revolution first in Egypt. I mean, basically, nobody's in charge in Egypt right now. I mean, things are... The government is operating, but there's nobody who can order, hey, let's go into Libya and help liberate Libya and make it part of Egypt or something like that. In thousands of years past, you know, parts of Libya were part of Egypt, but again, that's another can of worms that nobody wants to get into, probably for good reason. But the Egyptians did want to be aware of what was going on over there, so they sent some of their guys in undoubtedly in civilian clothes. That border is still fairly open. Gaddafi probably is still trying to close or secure, as it were, at least the main roads across that border. But right now it's wide open, and the Egyptians are probably, you know, the 777 guys are already pulling their hair out, you know, trying to get the rebels organized. But the biggest problem the rebels have is that Gaddafi is better organized. He always had his Republican Guard, as it were, you know, a small unit that could race up and down that 1,800 kilometers of coastal highway. That is the country, basically. That and the oil fields further in the south. Besides the oil fields, there's no there. I mean, there are some nomads, but they have no combat power, so to speak. It's just a great empty, except for the oil, which is very valuable. And apparently some of the rebels control, you know, the interior oil fields. And of course, Gaddafi will next go after that. He wants to put his money, you know, back together again. But as long as you had the most powerful unit running back and forth along that road, you controlled the country. And all Gaddafi had to basically do was, you know, grab control of that country. There was chaos in the cities because, you know, once he started cutting off the, firing on merchant ships trying to get into the Tobruk, you know, all those ports along the coast, that was the end of the game. And you know, so without the Arab or UN or NATO or American, whoever, without someone's air support, you know, they basically have no choice. They had no chance, and no choice except, you know, basically to surrender. Restarting the revolution, as it were, after this may still be a possibility, but Gaddafi's going to be brutal, and he's not going to let any media in there under any circumstances. He's cut the internet. He's apparently cut most of the phone lines. He just wants the world to, you know, look somewhere else while he takes care of business.
Right. Austin, what are the long-term ramifications for the region from what has happened there?
Yeah, there are numerous ones. You know, I've written a couple of pieces about this over the last, I guess, two or three weeks, too. Let me make a comment on Jim's 1,800-mile long coast road, you know, armor unit running up and down that. We pointed out, and Jim did this piece too, this was early on though, that he really only had initially about 5,000 people. And that presidential, what he called, Jim called the Republican Guard Brigade, it's actually got a name and I'm blanking out on it now, I think it starts with a G, but it's a presidential guard unit, and then, you know, he's doubled that, apparently, doubled it in size. That's where you get the 10,000 figure from mercenaries brought in from outside, something, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, and the possibility of some support from friends, friendly regimes. So you can
Syria.
Parse that all you want. But Syria, that's exactly what I'm going to
I'll say
make a joke. But Dunnigan jumped.
And the Africans are largely Tuareg, you know, tribesmen that Gaddafi had been kind to in the past.
Yeah, pulling out of that. But there was a rumor for a while, and then it disappeared, that a couple of hundred Zimbabwean commandos had gone up there as well. That seemed to disappear. But a couple of hundred, that's one plane load. When you think about it, and if they're loyal to Mugabe and Mugabe's getting paid for them, you know, that's 200 jungle fighters that they're well paid and know how to use their automatic weapons. So he's succeeded in getting through the initial surge, where that you can end up with a scenario, the reality that Jim has painted about, you know, going up and down the coast road. I do want to point out a couple of things. He does, as he moves, even though he's got some resupply ability through the ports, as you get Benghazi and then you get towards Tobruk, you start running into a problem that Erwin Rommel ran into 70 years ago this month, guys. March 24th, 1941 is when Africa Corps broke out of El Agheila and took on the British and drove on to Tobruk. So you've got the odd historical connection to 70 years ago with Africa Corps. Not quite the same situation, though. Rommel was far more creative about where he went and what he did, but you still have that supply issue for his forces if the rebels are organized enough to take advantage of it. And then, of course, as you know, Dan and Jim, on the piece I wrote this week, I think, and I said this seriously, but there's also irony involved in it. I don't think the Norwegians would give a Nobel Peace Prize to an Egyptian Air Force general, but there would certainly be a real peace prize for Egypt, not necessarily Nobel, but a peace prize if the Egyptian Air Force did enforce a no-fly zone or provide air support for the rebels in eastern Libya. I think the chances of it are minimal, but I certainly don't see it coming from NATO. I don't see it coming from the United Nations, and I don't see it coming, unfortunately, from the United States either. And that's is how I'm, after all that wrap, getting back to your question of the long-term issues. Implication one is that repression works, and you can get away with it. And the so-called international community really only exists as a rhetorical gesture if you don't have the United States to take the leadership role. We knew that, but that's often not what we're told by certain media organizations. I think a subsidiary component of that is the outbreak of Arab demands for freedom, end of Arab dictatorships that you saw with the Jasmine Revolution in Tunisia, as you see as a muddling on through Egypt. And we're also seeing a little bit why Tunisia and Egypt may be special cases. But there was an end, however briefly, of Arab fear as being a means of repressing a population. Syria is a land of fear. Libya is a land of fear. Algeria, in its own way. Iraq was once upon a time. But I think that's something that you'll see, and it's not just, even though I coined using the term Arab fear. Look, China, the Chinese Communist government in Beijing starts in on its own dissidents. The internet outbreak of demands for liberty, or even reaches China, so-called shockwave from the Tunisian revolution. China, as cynical as this sounds, as terrible it sounds, the Chinese Communist government has an investment in Gaddafi winning to one degree. Robert Mugabe and Hugo Chavez, Bashar al-Assad in Syria, they've all got an interest in seeing Gaddafi win, because outright brutal force, there's the lesson to a population that has the temerity to rise up and question the big man, the strong man. Not in question, but to fight him. I think Jim's Rwanda analogy unfortunately, and I'm not laughing, it's kind of a desperation sigh, is unfortunately correct. Because I see brutality coming out of Gaddafi. When I broke in on you guys when you were talking, I said, mass grave sites. If you read the 91 or 92 edition, Jim, of Quick and Dirty Guide to War, talking about what we were going to see in Bosnia, I mean, gee, my knee, Bob, guys, by the time the 96 edition came out, we'd already seen the mass grave sites were turning up. What Saddam did to the Shia farmers in the March 1991 rebellion. Hey, that's 20 years ago. Hey, look, we picked up something 70 years ago. March is not April's not the cruelest month. That's a bad T.S. Eliot line. It seems to be March in parts of the Middle East. You're going to see the same kind of slaughter. I don't know that there'll be cameras on it like there were in Rwanda. And some degree that we got evidence out of what was going on in southern Iraq in 1991, because as Jim pointed out, Gaddafi shut down he shut down the internet now, but there's still plenty of people with cell phone cameras to be able to take a few pictures, and they'll eventually get out, and there will be the gruesome fact that I argued, Dan, I think it was 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, that even a special forces component providing some degree of air cover with shoulder fired anti-aircraft missiles like Stinger would could not buy time, save lives, certainly a no-fly zone. And if Egypt acted between now and the next 10 to 12 days, as I pointed out, the long road they still have to go to get to Tobruk. And I think that, that there's still a fighting chance for the rebellion. But the international community, unless there is American leadership, is highly fragmented. It's a rhetorical. It exists only rhetorically. And that's we're seeing that. It's just a collection of words, unless it has unless they exercise U.S. leadership, and the current administration is not doing that.
Now, Jim, there was this interesting argument about the no-fly zone, saying that, well, it wasn't going to be effective because it wasn't going to handle the helicopters. Now, was that just a spillover because we didn't handle the helicopters in Iraq in in 91 and 92?
Well, there have been final agreement on exactly what a no-fly zone would be. It's recognized that it was a big mistake to allow Saddam to move his helicopters because, you know, they became his air force in effect. A no-fly zone, basically an effective no-fly zone means not only not letting anything Gaddafi has fly, but it should also apply to any of his warships and any of his military vehicles. You know, no-fly means no movement by, you know, your military personnel. If it's got a gun on it, it doesn't move. That is still giving him a free ride, you know, with his SUVs or trucks or whatever. But, you know, it at least forces him to play on the same level field, as it were, as his opponents. But, you know, basically, I mean, you know, they just had released a poll. You know, most Germans do not want to get involved in the war. You know, so the Germans, you know, once again, you know, turn their heads away when there's something nasty going on somewhere. They did that all throughout World War II. I hate to make a cheap shot like that, but it's accurate. You know, nobody wants to get involved.
It is accurate. That's dead accurate, Jim. And that's not a cheap shot. That's, sorry.
Well, some people will accuse me of making it a cheap shot, but I'm just trying to, you know, elaborate on where that's coming from. This is, as you point out, you know, I mean, we're not seers. We simply, you know, follow the logical progression of historical events, you know. And so what happened in World War II, what happened, you know, and World War II was the first major war where the media was pervasive. And you know, and there was no excuse for, you know, this stuff not getting out. The problem in World War II was it was just so horrible. A lot of people said, I can't believe this. Is this guy credible? And more and more witnesses kept coming back saying, you know, this, saying that. I mean, people who were not connected. I mean, any intel operative could tell you that, you know, yes, this is probably credible because this very unlikely these people are running a, you know, a coordinated con on us. And then when it gets up to, you know, to Rwanda and then, you know, Srebrenica, and now Libya, you know, let's face it, guys, you know, I mean, we've seen this before. We know what's going on, but nobody wants to act.
Right.
So they're gonna have to answer for that.
Let me make a historical point, though. And it's this Turco-Italian War of 1911-1912. Actually, that was fairly well covered by the media because it was so static. What am I talking about? Because people that read strategy page, I've written a couple of things about this, but I got to give it a plug. There's a chapter in my book coming out this summer on Kemal Ataturk that's got a chapter on that war. All of the major cities that we're talking about that Rommel rolled through or rolled out of, or you're hearing Gaddafi counterattack, or crop up as battle sites. And essentially, all the Italians, when they arrived to knock the Turks out in September of 1911, as they sat in the cities because their navy could support it, but they couldn't get out. They didn't have the transportation logistics capability to push into the interior to deal with the desert tribes and the Turkish light forces that were out in the desert. Why do I say the media was present? Because telegraph, the French had a telegraph line running from Tunis down to a town that was right on the Libya-Tunisia border, and all of the correspondents would go over and hang out with the Turks and then come back, and you would have, they'd file on the telegraph. Virtually the same thing was happening over on the eastern side, the Egyptians with the Libyans, at least around Tobruk. So you had correspondents that could get stories out about Tripoli and Tobruk. It was much harder in the interior because now you have to, you know, move by camel or walk to get to the telegraph line. But it was covered. People knew, people knew about it. That said, why did I bring it up? Some of the issues that exist right now between the Western Libya and Eastern Libya, Tripolitania, being the old Roman province where Tripoli is, and Cyrenaica, which is where Benghazi and Tobruk are, were at play in that war as well. I mean, in some ways, you can almost say that they're two different countries, which feeds back into Jim's point, which is with some of the Egyptians saying, how come Eastern Libya, part of it doesn't belong to Egypt as it should? Anyway, I thought I'd toss that out. There's a, in some ways, this war, Dan, has the aspects of a Tripolitanian versus Cyrenaican civil war. Jim, any comment on that?
Well, Gaddafi always ran his government as his tribe, Bedouin. I forget the name of the tribe. It isn't Gaddafi.
He's down there. He's from Sirte on the bottom of the Gulf of Sirte.
No, he is from the Tripoli area, but he basically got allies, as it were, much like the Saudis put together Saudi Arabia, and it's still like that. There were people you could trust and people you couldn't trust. And basically, Gaddafi stuck it to those who, would not play ball with him. And you always had, actually, Libya is divided into five or six major, tribal coalitions, our people and everybody else is those others. But Gaddafi basically made Tripoli the center of the Libyan universe. That's where all the goodies went to. Now Benghazi was the big city, in the east, and that was always, as you just pointed out, the Tripolitanians and the Cyrenians. And that's what this came down to when there was a general uprising. I mean, a lot of people in Tripoli are fed up with Gaddafi, because, he didn't basically, he couldn't count on all of his own kinsmen, to support him, because basically he's a whack job. Now, he's crazy, but he's got guns, and he's got people behind him who will use their guns. And that's what they're doing right now, and that's going to be the tragedy the media is going to feast off, for the next month or so. Always in this terrible, why didn't we do something? But right now, I mean, there are people who could just, make one phone call and get things moving, and they're not.
Right.
They're responsible.
Look, that those Libyan naval assets, those ships, I'm sounding like a
couple of patrol ships.
They're patrol boats. They aren't even a torpedo. Is what it would take to relieve that very, very thin naval. Blockade that he's got on Benghazi and Tobruk, and I suspect Derna as well, which is between.
Well, the Chinese sent one of their frigates up to Benghazi to make sure that nobody interfered with the ships they had chartered to take off 30-some thousand Chinese, expatriates. They could have left that ship there just basically to guard Benghazi, but they didn't. I mean, there's so many people who could have done something who haven't.
Right. Yeah, we'd rather fill out the brackets for the NCAA championships, I guess.
Well, you said that, Dan. I didn't.
I'm sorry. That slipped out. I'm sorry.
Well, no, it isn't the people who are distracted by the NCAA. It's basically the people at the top. I mean, you know, there's Sarkozy, who at one point was saying, let's do something, but he didn't feel, you know, brave enough to send, you know, French troops or French aircraft and naval ships down there to do something. The Italians at one point, you know, were saying, Berlusconi, you know, he probably thought, you know, wag the dog. They get people off my back about my, you know, sex life. But at the end, you know, he said, let's not do that. The Egyptians could have done something. I mean, granted, nobody's in charge. I mean, it's hard to find anybody who would push the button. At best, they were able to get some of their commandos in there just to find out what's going on. And who knows? The 777 guys might have come back and said, guys, it's a mess. Nobody's in charge. You know, the rebels are basically, you know, and let me give you a list. It's a long list of people who are basically rebelling, running their own little separate rebellions. And so the Egyptians might have said, well, all right, that's a mess. Let them sort it out themselves. Yeah, and the list goes on. So there'll be a long list of, villains when people ask, you know, who did fall when it's all over.
Right. Now let's quickly switch just before we wrap up this, Austin, to the effects of the tsunami on the world.
Well, one thing it did, and I don't mean this to be dismissive, but this was, as it hit, this ran through my mind, and now I've seen comments on the web to this effect. It took Libya off the headlines, for one thing it did, and a natural disaster. That's not to say that we're not dealing with a significant event. Heck, it really is huge. I noticed the U.S. Geographic Survey upped it from an 8.9 to a 9.0 flat, 9.0 Richter scale magnitude earthquake. Huge tsunami that it launched that hit the Japanese coast within 2 minutes. How many people are dead? Well, that first figure we saw from 1,000 to 1,700 has already been exceeded because at least two villages were near totally destroyed. And, you know, in Japan, you're talking about, you know, we call them villages, but they're places that have 2,000-3,000 people living right there on the coast. And they literally, the loss of life, and we're just now beginning to sort it out. We're starting to get into several thousands, and soon we, you know, there are figures out there between 6,000 to 9,000, 10,000 as we record that. That's a huge loss of life, especially, and I don't say this to sound cynical, just a statement of fact here, especially in a first world country. That's the
right.
That's the thing, is that you're dealing with a country that knows how to get things done, that has, this may sound tangential, it's not, very rigorous building codes, that has extraordinary infrastructure, communications, all types of communications, redundancy, has redundancy in its power grid. But this was so big, Dan, that in the local, there at Fukushima, the local power grid and everything around those reactors, it just smashed. And now we're dealing with the component that has really grabbed the global headlines because it's nuclear, and you've got issues with, as we speak now, the biggest problem seems to me, and I'm actually relying on several experts I happen to know that have been, I've been getting an email or contact with them, over heating, melting of spent fuel rods. You've got a situation that the people that I trust the most say extremely dangerous but manageable. And yet, not to give somebody else a boost, but I was looking at Drudge Report just about 3 hours ago, and, you know, it looks like Armageddon is, and that some of the headlines that Drudge links to. You've got a dimension here is what are the effects on the global economy? Japan is China just passed them for GDP. Is that right?
Japan is number three now.
If you're number three, that's huge. Come on, and they're, you know, the 120, 130 million Japanese with a huge GDP. What are the domestic effects? I don't think we know yet, but those reactors provide a significant portion of, at the margin of Japanese electricity power production. You will see this in some way an effect, a global economic effect, and then you're already seeing here in the United States a reaction against use a nuclear power. You heard it from several senators. There's echoes of that, surprisingly, according to a news report, several news reports actually I read this morning out of China, that the Chinese are going to reconsider some of their nuclear plant programs. I actually think that's a good idea, because I don't know what China, kind of analysis China does on where it's going to put its plants in relation to earthquake zones and faults. Maybe they need to take a second look at it. But that said, my opinion on this is that the United States is woefully short on what it should be producing from nuclear plants, and I think we are seeing already the same kind of reluctance, recalcitrance, and outright rejection by certain portions of the certain people in the United States, certain portions of the electorate, against fission power. And I think that's a mistake. I think that's been a mistake on the U.S.'s part since about 1982 or 1983. And, again, that's my opinion on it.
But, yeah.
There you go.
Now, one of the things that's happened is basically, Jim, this is taking the Japanese military offline for any other purposes, right?
Yeah, they are the best equipped, probably the best trained military in East Asia. About 240,000 troops active duty. They have a reserve that'll bring it up to 300,000. They've taken some losses in the north. We reported the one airfield that was 2 meters above sea level. The Tsusami was at 6 or 7 meters, so do the math. Wiped out a squadron, actually the training squadron of their JF-2 fighters, which are an improved F-16 they built themselves, about 20% of their F-2 force. Now, they've taken some other losses. There's been some damage to other military bases in northern Honshu, and some ships got banged up a bit. But the big thing that's going to hurt them is they've mobilized the military, probably the reserves as well as the active duty people. So they're going to be tied up with earthquake relief, you know, for a few months at least. And that's going to cut into their training. They'll probably keep, you know, obviously coastal patrol and, you know, aircraft, you know, air defense, as it were, going. But it's going to hurt their training. So the impact of the quake is going to reverberate for several years, you know, before they get back to the level of training that they were at before the March 11th quake hit. So it's going to hurt them, but it's certainly not going to do any permanent damage. It'll probably help in that the troops are going to get out there and operate in an emergency situation. That's always good, you know, get the pucker factor working there. And, of course, people will feel better about the military because they're all over the place, you know, digging people out, setting up refugee camps and what have you. Overall, it's not going to have a major impact on the military.
Now, have you heard anything about how it may have impacted? I know we did not have a large presence up north, but we did have some listening posts and intelligence up there.
Very minor operations up there. If any Americans were hurt or injured, we probably would have heard of it because, you know, the next of kin, as it were, the families. These guys can, you know, get the message out pretty quickly. If any Americans were hurt, that would have leaked out to the press. So undoubtedly, there's been nothing. I mean, most of the American military personnel are further south, and the only thing they're getting are possible warnings, you know, to beware of fallout, as it were, you know, from the cores that are getting exposed to the spent nuclear fuel, which is apparently the biggest problem. So there's probably going to be negligible, American military casualties. The big problem is like Chernobyl, which this has not approached yet in terms of, you know, radioactivity release.
Yeah.
Is the prevailing winds carrying the stuff into the atmosphere. Now, in Japan, the prevailing winds are towards us. than Chernobyl, the wind patterns were a little more complicated. They went north, and then they went west. So the Scandinavia got caught a lot of this, and northern England. There were apparently some crops, you know, some food that was disposed of, as it were, in Scotland and throughout, you know, Scandinavia in the year or so after Chernobyl. But it's certainly not as nightmarish as the media makes it out to be.
Right.
That's their business, to turn, you know, a minor accident into a nightmare.
Yeah, I know. Even for it to be a threat to the United States, people don't understand that it would have to be injected into the atmosphere pretty high for it to even make it over here.
Quantities, yeah.
Right.
So you're going to get, you know, epidemiologists will come out and say, well, it might be another dozen cancers, and that'll people add two zeros and run with that.
Right. Well, I think that unless you have something else to say about Japan, Austin, I think that about wraps us up.
No, I'm surprised that quickly we covered a lot.
We covered a lot of territory.
Disaster relief, our armed forces, some degree political relations, and so anyway, welcome to Strategy Page.
We've had a lot of practice.
Yeah, and we do. You know, I monitor all the. It's interesting. I get a real feel for what our military is doing or focusing on from monitoring all the photos that our military puts out. Most of the photos that are coming out right now are actually dealing with the relief efforts in Japan. So that's where the military is really focused right now, other than our efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq. So our guys are over there working hard. So we wish them.
I'll make one other comment. The Japanese self-defense forces, though they're becoming increasingly, I think it's no longer the Maritime Self-Defense Force, Jim. Hadn't they decided to call themselves the Japanese Navy again? Or
they're still a Self-Defense Force. That got shot.
Yeah, but they're coming close to being the Japanese. Honestly, they really are first-rate. The contacts I had with the Japanese Army personnel, which were minimal, but nevertheless, they were most impressive. So, and I know what information we get at the Strategy Page. They really are a very cracked force. So.
Yeah. The biggest problem, I think that's a bigger problem than the radiation actually, is the cold. And people don't realize that is a very cold area. It is like our Northwest.
Oh, it's cold.
And it's turned cold. You know, you're talking upstate New York cold.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that is the biggest danger to the millions that have been displaced. And we pray for them and pray for our boys that are over there helping them out. And we hope that everything goes as well as it can. Well, we'll talk to you guys next time. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.